The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Patricia for the North Carolina Reading Service, and for the next hour, I'll be reading to you from Time Magazine. Today's program is underwritten by G. Suggs Insurance. Please contact G. Suggs Insurance, your local independent agency, for trusted advice on home, auto, business, and life insurance. For more information, please visit gsuggsinsurance.com. That is gsuggsinsurance.com. Or call 919-875-8889. Today's edition of Time Magazine is actually a step back in time. It is dated October 11/October 18, 2021. Time is in white, large, capital, bold lettering on the front of the cover, which is, as usual, bordered in red with a fine white border inside the red border. And then there is a blue-green background upon which is superimposed a portrait of Jane Goodall. She is wearing an elegant pashmina, if I have pronounced that correctly. It's a lovely shawl in a teal blue coloration over a camel-colored turtleneck. She is wearing a pendant in what appears to be black enamel with a diamond or at least some type of inset stone, and it is a silhouette of the continent of Africa as if it were shown on a map. Her hands are clasped in front of her. She has aged-looking hands. Her face, however, is youthful-looking. She looks directly into the camera with brownish-green eyes, only a hint of lip rouge, and her hair is gray and white, pulled back from her face into some kind of a clasp at her neck, because we do see some gray-white ringlets on the back of her neck. Moving then to an article from within this issue of Time Magazine. It says, "Welcome to the future, Time 2030, that is 2030. Ideas for a fairer world in the Time 2030 section, with a few short articles here. Leaders from the business and policy-making community share their solutions for a more equitable and sustainable future. There appear to be four articles in varying sizes within the columns of these two pages. Rethink Our Approach to Inclusion by Ellen Pao, P-A-O, CEO, Project Include. We need a reset. We know we have racism, sexism, ableism, homophobia, and additional forms of bias and discrimination built into our workplaces, our schools, our medical care, and all our institutions. We know it is systemic and harmful. In the tech industry, its products are harming our brains, our self-worth, our values, our pandemic response, our children, and our society. Social media platforms are enabling and amplifying white supremacy and other forms of hate for profit. Workers are struggling to make a living wage, while CEO billionaires work them harder, pay them less, create poor working environments, and hoard ill-gotten profits. In politics, we're witnessing attacks on voting rights, abortion, and housing. In schools and universities, teaching racism and science are under threat. In hospitals, Black, Latinx, and Southeast Asian workers hold the front line, while their communities get less access and worse care. We need to channel our energy for change, for transformation, for equity, and for fairness. Today we are not doing enough. Good intentions are not going to do it. Neither will social media posts or reading books. Advocating within our existing processes is not working. The greatest changes have come from workers organizing, individuals suing, or speaking up, and media coverage. Yet worker and leadership demographics are still stagnant, companies are blocking unions, and harm is increasing. We need to hold people accountable for the harm they cause, and that means tracking metrics and results. COVID-19 has highlighted and exacerbated harm in the workplace, with the burden on women and non-binary workers, Black, Latinx, Asian, and Indigenous employees, transgender, or disabled workers, and especially those at the intersections of these identities. It is time for action, for each and every one of us to be an active participant in change. We need more protests and walkouts to call out harm, more boycotts of companies that underpay and overburden their workers, more unions and organizing communities, more speaking up and pushing back when it matters, more people stepping back to make room for change. Meaningful change requires a complete reset. We need new paths and untested solutions. We need people to use their privilege not to take opportunities from others without it, but to share opportunities or step aside and give them to others. We need people who caused and enabled problems to make room for new leaders who will take risks to actually fix the problems. We need accountability for harm doers, like sexual harassers and direct discriminators. It also includes those who sit by and do nothing, who fail to hire, promote, and pay fairly, who nod their heads and do nothing to change the system. We need to measure progress and set goals for demographics in hiring, pay, retention, promotions, and leadership. We also need to reward those who meet the goals and hold those who do not accountable for failures. We cannot wait. If you have a position or opportunity because of privilege, share it with someone without that privilege. Or even better yet, give that opportunity to another person. Organize your coworkers or communities for a bigger voice and more impact. Take responsibility for long-term solutions and harm prevention by thinking through the impact of what you and your company do. Call out potential problems. Push for better solutions. Now is the time for us to take action, be an active participant for meaningful change. It is time to stand up for those who have not been protected. It is time to fight for what America should stand for, and it is going to take all of us working together to make it happen. Use Technology to Strengthen Democracy by Michael Seibel, Managing Director, Y, the letter, Combinator. Over the next decade, democratic governments will be tested by the rise of China. They will have to prove to their citizens and those of developing nations democracy can deliver widespread economic growth, stability, and security in the modern world. Once again, there will be a global competition between two very different forms of government, and right now the outcome is uncertain. For democracies to win this contest, they will need to leverage software to deliver more prosperity to a wider cross-section of their populations, while still preserving individual rights. They have powerful potential allies in the private tech sector who could be of service building and selling industry-leading software to democratic governments. They should be intrinsically motivated, because helping preserve democracy also safeguards the marketplace rules these companies depend upon to generate financial returns. In the following 10 years, the chief executive officers of every large software company in a democratic country must embrace a new key performance indicator, the success of the software of democracy. The software industry should view democratic governments as their most important customers in the upcoming decade and create the tools they need to thrive. Reduce reliance on animal-sourced food by Mireille Zaki, Z-A-K-I, Managing Partner, Dismatrix Group, D-I-S-M-A-T-R-I-X Group. No rate of growth is sustainable when the world has finite resources. Producing food through animals is inefficient, wasteful, and dangerous. Today, animal agriculture, including many kinds of meat and dairy, as well as fish farming, uses roughly 80% of all arable land and 41% of all fresh water. It also produces nearly 60% of agricultural emissions, and it's the leading cause of wildlife extinction, deforestation, and loss of biodiversity. Yet it produces less than 18% of all calories consumed globally. It is also the cause of zoonotic diseases such as COVID and a root cause of antibiotic-resistant diseases. In a few years, there will be a gap of 40% between demand of fresh water and actual freshwater supply, largely driven by agriculture, making production of food through animals all but implausible. As the world's population grows, producing food through innovative use of plants becomes the answer. Avoiding traditional meat, dairy, and farmed fish, food production would free 75% of all arable land, while abundantly housing and feeding a rapidly growing global population. Innovation in plant-based food production is advancing rapidly. Some of the analog meats and dairy products are arguably indistinguishable from the animal-based versions. Their resource and environmental impact is relatively negligible. At the same time, technologies such as cell culture and precision fermentation promise to radically revolutionize food production. Meat or fish grown in cell cultures are derived from the animal-based originals, reducing the comparable use of resources and emissions to a fraction. Precision fermentation, which has been used for many years for insulin, or food ingredients such as rennet, is already presenting remarkable progress, potentially solving protein and other production gaps. Through the use of selected bacterial cultures, it can produce several molecules normally found in meat and dairy. Some processes are net carbon negative, using CO2 as an ingredient. Moving away from industrially produced animal-based food is not just an option, it is a necessity. And that article was written with assistance from Sebastiano Coscia Castiglione. And finally, Tackle Emissions from Energy by Fatih Birol, B-I-R-O-L, Executive Director, IEA. Scientists tell us that if we want to have a livable planet in coming decades, then emissions need to come down to net zero by 2050. That's 2050. As around three-quarters of the emissions that cause climate change come from energy, we at the International Energy Agency have turned this net zero target into a roadmap for the energy sector. What needs to happen? We have described more than 400 milestones. For example, in 2030, 60% of cars sold should be electric vehicles, compared with 5% today. By 2040, half of all flights should be using sustainable fuels, and the world needs to have phased out all coal and oil power plants where emissions are not captured. If we do these things, are we sure we will keep the global temperature rise to 1.5 degrees centigrade? The answer is, I am not sure. But even if we do not succeed entirely, if we do our best and follow this roadmap, we will still help avoid the worst of climate change. If we cannot reach 1.5 degrees, then 1.6 or 1.7 is still far better than 3.5 degrees, where the consequences for our planet will be catastrophic. This is a race not between countries, but a race against time. And that statement was as told to Justin Warland. The Risk Report by Ian Bremmer. Angela Merkel didn't just save Europe, she strengthened it. Germany's election of September 26, 2021 ended without a clear winner. But one thing at least is certain, Angela Merkel will soon exit the political stage she has occupied for the past 16 years, kick-starting much debate about her legacy for Germany and for the world. Comparisons with her mentor and predecessor, Helmut Kohl, that's K-O-H-L, who led Germany through reunification, are as inevitable as they are unfair. The demands of their eras were entirely different, and to understand that is to recognize Merkel's lasting achievement. In 1990, a heady sense of opportunity in both West and East Germany created the public support that Kohl needed to reunite the country. Over the Merkel era, by contrast, Germans and Europeans generally have needed a thoughtful, flexible problem solver to guide them through a debt emergency, a surge of migrants from the Middle East, and a global pandemic. In the process, Angela Merkel helped save the European Union. That is an accomplishment that deserves lasting respect. Angela is spelled A-N-G-E-L-A, Merkel, M-E-R-K-E-L. Convinced that a strong and cohesive EU would be good for her country, the German Chancellor bridged the gaps and cut the deals that helped Europe's most deeply indebted nations survive the 2010-2012 sovereign debt crisis. Merkel kept her word that Germany would lead the way in coping with the 2015-2016 migrant crisis by welcoming more than 1 million desperate people into her country. In response to the pandemic and the need for a bold economic recovery plan, she shifted German opinion on the need for common European debt. Her critics say these decisions fuel the populism and cynicism that have threatened to poison European politics. But without Merkel and her willingness to take on more costs and risks so that others could take less, the EU might have lost more than just Britain. Her leadership has also been good for most Germans. Some 70% now say they are happy with their economic circumstances. Much of Germany's success might have happened without her, powered by new export opportunities in China and cheap labor from Eastern European countries. But Merkel's ability to manage emergencies has helped keep Germany's economic engine humming. Unemployment's now near its lowest point of the Merkel era. In addition, a balanced budget law enacted in 2009 has helped keep public debt low. There's much more Merkel could have done, to be sure. By balancing its books, Germany has invested far less than it might have in renewable energy. While some credit Merkel for transitioning Germany away from risky nuclear power, the country's carbon emissions are high by European standards. Although Merkel remains popular, her party does not. She leaves with an 80% approval rating, even as the center-right alliance she led is in historic decline. In the September election, the CDU-CSU secured just over 24% and finished narrowly behind their center-left rivals, the SPD. Whoever emerges as next chancellor will be seen by most Germans as a pale shadow of her leadership. Not only is Merkel a tough act to follow in Germany, there's also no one else now in Europe who can match her tenacity and resilience. In particular, French President Emmanuel Macron, facing re-election this year inspires too much mistrust, including in France, to inherit Merkel's ability to guide combative European leaders toward agreement. Fortunately, Merkel has strengthened Europe itself by showing other leaders compromise is possible for the good of all. That makes future crises less likely, a legacy worth celebrating. The View essay, Parenting. Did I point my kids to the wrong North Star? Looking back, maybe I should not have used the phrase, when this is over, quite so often when talking about the pandemic with my kids. It was not that I thought everything would return to the status quo, or that the status quo is anything to be content with. And it was not that I believed we would remain unaltered after COVID-19 upended our routines and sense of safety. But part of what kept us going through the first year of pandemic, through grief and loneliness, remote work and learning, was the hope of life after. Even when it became clear millions of Americans were unwilling to take basic precautions to limit the spread of the virus, I still believed most would get vaccinated as soon as they were able to protect themselves if the collective good could not sway them. So when my children asked, when will this be over, I encouraged them to look forward to a time when we would all have access to safe and effective vaccines. And for about 6 weeks of summer, with three-quarters of our household vaccinated, we did experience some of those joys we had once taken for granted. Friends came over for dinner. My sister flew out from the West Coast to visit. The kids spent a week at their grandparents' house. My husband and I registered our children for what we hoped would be a far more typical school year. With local infection rates so low, we wondered whether our school system would even bother requiring masks. I started looking at flights home to southern Oregon, hoping to visit my mother's grave for the first time. Now hospitals in hard-hit areas are filled with unvaccinated COVID-19 patients, and infections and deaths have spiked once more. While our family has not retreated into our pandemic bubble, it feels as though our options have contracted. We're back to evaluating each and every risk, trying to avoid the unnecessary ones because our children, one of whom is too young to be vaccinated, cannot escape the necessary risk of school. Sending them into crowded school buildings flies against my every protective instinct as a parent, especially after keeping them home for more than a year. The week before school started, I was plagued with insomnia. A hard, painful knot had formed in my chest, reminiscent of the way stress had lived in my body during the months when my mother was dying. I know that some part of this trauma is a trauma response, not only from the pandemic, but also from losing both my parents and my grandmother in a 2-year span. I was not doing well when all of this began. Yet even without such recent losses, I suspect I would be struggling now, because when I speak with friends, fellow parents, I hear many of my fears echoed back. I would say that I do not know how we got through that first shaky week of this third pandemic-impacted school year, except I do know we had no choice. We still don't. Though we're grateful to their teachers and glad our kids are once again learning alongside their peers, the worry persists, an undercurrent to which we've been forced to adapt. Each week brings more pediatric infections, more student quarantines. Each day I am conscious of the fact I'm allowing my children to assume a risk from which I, working at home, am protected. I read every update to the school COVID-19 guidelines, so I know what to expect after the inevitable exposure, but I can't tell my kids what they have long wanted to know. When will things go back to the way they remember? Nearly every interview with a public health expert once included the question, when will things get back to normal? and I always found myself reading the replies with an almost childlike eagerness, a need to be comforted or at least told what to expect. But part of living through the pandemic, for those of us who have thus far been lucky enough to live through it, is realizing we've lost too many and too much for this ever to be over. 1 in 500 Americans have died of COVID-19. With a higher share of deaths in Black, Latinx, and Native communities, millions of people, including a statistically small but heartbreaking number of kids, now live with symptoms of long COVID. No matter how low cases fall, we have crossed into new terrain and cannot go back. And I think this can be a hard truth to communicate to our children as we toe that line between wanting to be honest and wanting to protect them from further trauma. So many of them were already threatened by racist violence, mass shootings, the deadly effects of a largely unchecked climate emergency, long before COVID-19 came to devastate our communities. So much has been asked of our kids, so much that they should have been able to count on has proved elusive, unrecoverable. They have suffered every kind of instability and trauma that adults have over the past year and a half, all while having to rely on us to shield them from fire and flood, infection, and death. I know my intentions were good when I encouraged my own children to expect an end to the alarming spread, the immediate peril of this virus. I did not want them to despair, and I honestly believed vaccines would bring about a return to normalcy or something like it. But now, with Delta's high transmissibility rate, fears over still more variants, and millions still unvaccinated, I do not think I'm the only parent wondering if I've pointed them toward the wrong North Star. While I expect that our own relative risk will downshift once all four of us are vaccinated, and I continue to tell my kids things will get better, I'm no longer certain they believe me, nor am I certain they have a reason to, given how grievously so many adults have failed to take the easiest steps to keep them safe. What can we offer our children now, if not the promise of an uninterrupted school year or a guarantee that they can trust adults to try to protect them from a host of dangers? How do we help them live and learn when we, their parents and caregivers, lack that most basic of foundations to stand on? For now, I keep telling my kids I love them, that many people do want to keep them safe and are trying their best, and that I know they're doing their best in the hardest time we have known, and this makes me prouder than ever. I did not expect to find myself blinking back tears when I picked up my 10-year-old the first day of school and saw throngs of masked children streaming from the doors, something I had not witnessed since March 2020. I was moved at the sight of those students with their heavy backpacks and heavier burdens. They were doing such a brave thing, and many of them probably did not even realize it. They were just happy to be together again. By following rules established for their safety, they were doing everything in their limited power to take care of one another. If some of our children are frustrated with us, if they are angry so many adults continue to make choices that put them and other vulnerable members of our society at risk, if it is hard for them to picture an end to this pandemic, that's more than fair. In a time of enormous loss and uncertainty, I've come to believe my focus as a parent should not be on managing their feelings or expectations, or predicting a more stable future that might not come to be. I cannot supply all the answers they seek, or promise all the outcomes they deserve. But I can affirm what they're experiencing while encouraging them to act with compassion and recognize their responsibility to others. Over the past 18 months, a common refrain has been, This pandemic should compel all of us to recognize our interdependence. The inescapable fact we will not address this or any of the other grave threats we are facing without collective action. This is a lesson I expect many of our children are also learning, though the cost feels too high. I know I do not want my kids to conclude they're powerless or that there's no one who will fight with and for them. There are many things I still have to hope for to get through each day. And while our children's survival and health top the list, I also want them to retain their faith in themselves and in their ability to look forward to something better than this, to find, as they so often do, their own reasons for hope. The writer of this article, Nicole Chung, is author of the memoir, All You Can Ever Know. The free money experiment, Inside America's Test of Guaranteed Income, by Abby Vesoulis, Compton, and Abigail Abrams. One evening in early June, Leo and his family were able to enjoy a treat they had not experienced in months, a sit-down meal at a restaurant. At a fried chicken chain in a Compton, California strip mall, four of them splurged on a few plates of fried rice, which added up to about $60. Leo, 39, who works as a mechanic, said the dinner felt like a luxury. "It made me very happy," he says in Spanish. The family was only able to afford a dinner out because Leo was recently selected to participate in a groundbreaking economic experiment called the Compton Pledge. Between late 2020 and the end of 2022, Leo and 799 other participants will receive, in regular intervals, a defined cash payment, between $300 and $600 monthly, depending on the number of dependents they have, and they can spend however they like. Leo, an undocumented immigrant from Guatemala, whom Time has agreed to refer to by a pseudonym, will receive $900 every 3 months. The Fund for Guaranteed Income, the nonprofit organization running the Compton Pledge, has partnered with a research group to study the extent to which these relatively modest payments will impact the recipients' lives, their physical and psychological health, their job prospects, and their communities. In the past 6 years, similar pilot programs have rolled out in nearly 24 cities around the country, from St. Paul, Minnesota, to Paterson, New Jersey, according to the Stanford Basic Income Lab. Most of the programs, Compton's included, are privately funded, and many target specific populations like black pregnant women or former foster children. The Compton Pledge, which includes a diverse cross-section of the city's residents, is among the most inclusive of the pilot projects and is the largest in terms of the number of people receiving payments. But all of these new laboratories of wealth redistribution are designed to study the same question. What happens when you give society's poorest people cold, hard cash and let them spend it however they want? Interest in such guaranteed income programs has exploded in recent years, driven in part by dissatisfaction with the current difficult-to-navigate maze of government benefits, which often leave the most needy without support. During his long-shot 2020 presidential campaign, Andrew Yang popularized the idea of a universal basic income, UBI, a subtype of guaranteed income. as a strategy to eliminate most existing government welfare programs. And amid the COVID-19 economic crisis, Congress has experimented with short-term guaranteed income projects of its own, distributing three rounds of no-strings-attached stimulus checks to eligible Americans over the past 18 months. Polling on the topic's limited, but according to an August 2020 Pew Research Center survey, roughly 45% of Americans say they support the idea of the government giving every adult citizen, regardless of employment or income, $1,000 per month. While a sustained federally run guaranteed income program is not politically feasible right now, proponents of the idea say the tide is turning. 5 years ago, guaranteed income programs were largely relegated to economic seminars and think pieces in leftist outlets. Now it is a topic on presidential debate stages and an actual policy across the Atlantic in Spain, where the government's offering 850,000 very poor families up to the U.S. equivalent of $1,200 per month. Nika Soon-Shiong, executive director of the Fund for Guaranteed Income, says the question is not whether there will ever be a national guaranteed income stateside, but when. To speed up that process, the Fund for Guaranteed Income has made the technological interface it created to distribute cash payments available to other programs. This is an inevitable future, she says. Soon-Shiong, a doctoral candidate in international development, planned to launch a privately run guaranteed income experiment after completing her thesis at the University of Oxford on cash transfer systems in India. But the COVID-19 economic crisis accelerated her timeline. It really felt like there were not enough people thinking about the solution, she says. Soon-Shiong, who had returned home to West Hollywood when COVID-19 struck, turned her attention to her own backyard. Compton, whose 100,000 residents are mostly black and Latino, was hit particularly hard. There's a photograph here of Compton. It's in black and white. It's really just an intersection which says Compton Boulevard, with the streetlights and the mountains in the background and trees in the foreground and a couple of stores. One is a 7-Eleven and one is something or other merchandise on its one-story facade. And back to the text. With an average household income $10,000 lower than the national median of $62,800, its residents suffer disproportionately from an array of diseases that increase the lethality of COVID-19, including obesity and diabetes, according to data compiled by the L.A. County Department of Public Health. So in mid-2020, Soon-Shiong approached Aja Brown, then mayor of Compton, to bring some of the city's struggling residents a reprieve. Unlike some existing welfare benefits that guaranteed income pilots, Soon-Shiong and Brown's plan would include undocumented immigrants and formerly incarcerated people. Participants were selected randomly from a list of low-income Compton residents compiled from city records and community leaders like Baptist ministers and immigration attorneys. Starting in August 2020, Soon-Shiong, daughter of billionaire Dr. Patrick Soon-Shiong, helped raise $9.2 million from donors, including Amazon Studios and California Wellness Foundation, to fund the payments. Compton Pledge recipients were given no instructions or requirements on how to spend their payments. But most families interviewed by Time report using some for health-related costs. Three of the four Compton Pledge families Time interviewed over the past 6 months expressed they are battling chronic illnesses. Leo's first $900 installment was meted out carefully. $250 for a car diagnostic tool that will enable him to take on more mechanic jobs. $150 on a college textbook for his 23-year-old stepdaughter. A few hundred dollars to his ailing mother in Guatemala. $90 in payments toward a $3,000 payday loan that's accrued nearly $1,000 in interest fees in less than 2 years. The extra financial cushion has not yet put a dent in the $10,612.80 hospital bill Leo recently received after going to the emergency room for chest pains that a physician linked to stress. Two more black and white photographs appear here. Leo used some of his Compton Pledge money on dinner out with his wife and stepdaughter. So in the center is a man, middle-aged, a little less than, dressed casually, but he's very neatly shaven. He has facial hair, and he has a receding hairline. On either side is a female. One is about his age, probably his wife, and then a younger woman, his stepdaughter. They're both casually dressed also, but with neatly dressed hair. And everybody's just looking pleasant, not necessarily smiling, but looking pleasant at the camera. Then the lower photo, also in black and white, is that of a sophisticated-looking young woman dressed in black slacks and a black top, sleeveless. She has long black hair, very long, more than shoulder length, more like waist length. And she's also pleasant-looking, standing against a backdrop of silhouettes of leaves. It's Nika Shong Sun Shong, and who planned to finish her doctorate before launching the Compton Pledge, but COVID-19 sped up her timeline. Returning to the text, Tiffany Hosley, a 40-year-old former teacher's assistant in the Compton Unified School District, is also receiving $900 quarterly. Unable to work since having a serious heart attack last October, Hosley says she uses a portion of her payment to defray the cost of her $988 per month heart medication, which was denied by her insurance. Compton Pledge, which has been operative since late 2020, has yet to release comprehensive data on the payment's effects, health or otherwise. But initial findings from a different guaranteed income pilot in Stockton, California, indicate recipients saw an overall improvement in their well-being. In March, the pilot reported recipients of its $500 per month stipend showed statistically significant improvements in mental health versus the control group, moving from likely having a mild mental health disorder to likely being mentally well. 1 year into the two-year pilot, Stockton recipients had spent 37% of their allotments on food, 22% on assorted merchandise, and 11% on utilities. They spent less than 1% on alcohol and tobacco. On average, recipients spent 3% on medical needs. Beyond covering their own needs, some Compton participants have said they plan to use their funds to support their communities. Georgia Horton, who became an evangelist preacher while serving a 25-year prison sentence for murder she says she did not commit, put her first $400 monthly payment toward the tools she needed to preach the gospel virtually, namely a new HP laptop and a Ring light. With subsequent checks, she paid registration and notarization fees to launch a nonprofit, Georgia Horton Ministries, which will lead trauma-informed prison workshops and support other formerly incarcerated people. Christine S., who asks that Time not use her last name, has committed hundreds of the $1,800 she receives quarterly toward feeding homeless individuals in Compton's historic Looters Park. Inspired by her own experience with homelessness, she plans to purchase a mobile shower so homeless people don't have to use garden hoses as she did. But her Compton pledge money also helped her take her daughter on a vacation to San Diego, where the toddler got to swim in a pool for the first time. The idea of guaranteeing a basic income is hardly new. Thinkers from all political persuasions, including Charles Murray, Milton Friedman, and Martin Luther King Jr., have suggested directing the government to inject cash directly into people's wallets. Prior to former President Bill Clinton's sweeping welfare reform measures in the 1990s, the U.S. provided millions of poor families an average of $374 monthly through a program called Aid to Families with Dependent Children. In the years since, U.S. lawmakers have repeatedly voted for direct payment stimulus checks as a tool to combat economic recession. The more recent explosion of guaranteed income experiments has been fueled in part by support from wealthy tech moguls. Twitter CEO Jack Dorsey has given to guaranteed income projects through his pound Start Small initiative, including donations of $15 million to the Open Research Lab, formerly Y Combinator's UBI project, and $18 million to Mayors for a Guaranteed Income, a group founded by former Stockton Mayor Michael Tubbs. In March, New York University used $3.5 million from Dorsey to launch the Cash Transfer Lab, a center that will study the effect of such policies. In the past 6 years, at least 40 new guaranteed income projects have been either launched or announced on a state and local level. Most are designed to help specific populations. A pilot project in Cambridge, Massachusetts, for example, targets single caretaker households, giving more than 100 families $500 per month for 18 months. The project in St. Paul, Minnesota, is helping up to 150 families whose finances were negatively impacted by COVID-19 with $500 monthly payments for 18 months. A pilot in Oakland, California, is focusing on non-white residents, offering $500 monthly for 18 months to 600 families earning below the area median income. A group in San Francisco is partnering with the city's Department of Health to give pregnant Black and Pacific Islander women $1,000 a month for the duration of their pregnancies and at least 6 months of the child's life. And in Jackson, Mississippi, the Magnolia Mothers Trust, now in its third cycle, is giving 100 Black mothers $1,000 monthly for 1 year. In July, California approved the nation's first state-funded guaranteed income project, designating $35 million for monthly cash payments to pregnant women and youth who have recently aged out of foster care. But even amid this wave of new interest, a sustained federal universal basic income, like a version Andrew Yang campaigned on, remains extraordinarily unlikely. Giving every American adult $1,000 per month, as Yang suggested, would cost the U.S. government more than $3.1 trillion per year, a sum equal to roughly 90% of all the money the federal government collected in revenue last year. Yang, along with fiscally conservative UBI advocates, insists the math makes sense, since such cash payments would allow the government to zero out other expensive entitlements like housing vouchers or food stamps. Others argue that a UBI should supplement the existing safety net and be paid for by wealth taxes, such as those advocated by progressive senators Elizabeth Warren and Bernie Sanders. They argue that while it takes money to invest in a larger social safety net, it is more expensive in the long run not to. Providing health care to uninsured people costs the country roughly $42.4 billion per year from 2015 to 2017, according to an estimate from the nonpartisan Kaiser Family Foundation. People who cannot pay rent or other bills are likely to need other services the government will end up paying for, like housing assistance. Poverty is also strongly linked to incarceration, which costs taxpayers at least $80 billion per year. Many moderate and conservative policymakers dismiss such arguments as magical thinking. While former President Donald Trump and many congressional Republicans supported sending stimulus checks to help Americans in the spring of 2020, they saw it as a short-term remedy to a once-in-a-century crisis, then quickly soured on more spending. Douglas Holtz Eakin, former director of the Congressional Budget Office and president of the Center-Right American Action Forum, points at the $28 trillion national debt and blames the pandemic-era stimulus spending for a recent uptick in inflation. This spring, Democrats, under pressure from moderates in their own caucus, narrowly passed a smaller stimulus bill with more targeted direct payments and limited unemployment benefits. Perhaps the most sustained objection to giving people free money, including increasing existing benefits, is that doing so discourages work. In Compton, nearly half a dozen small businesses, including a taco truck, an insurance shop, and a Chinese restaurant, told Time larger government unemployment checks, which expired in September, combined with direct cash payments through programs like the Compton Pledge, were making it difficult to hire workers. That sign's been out there for 6 months, says Roland Barsom, manager of a local auto insurance outlet, of a help wanted placard in his window. He hired two people to fill the clerical position, but neither lasted more than a few weeks. One of them stayed for about a month, he says, but she was getting more money staying home. Some experts say these critiques do not hold up. There's little to no evidence the federal income support programs are leading to work shortages, says Mark Zandi, chief economist at Moody's Analytics. Despite 26 states voluntarily ending supplemental unemployment insurance early, there was little difference in their employment numbers and workforce participation rates in July. Participants in guaranteed income experiments also generally report cash payments did not allow them to stop working. Daniel Page, 28, who participated in the Jackson program, continued to work as a Head Start teacher, attending graduate school and taking care of her two children. Her two children, ages 8 and 3, while their father's military job kept him stationed several states away. The money from Magnolia Mother's Trust has helped her keep up with her electric bill and car payment, and she's hoping to save enough to move to a safer neighborhood after losing a loved one to gun violence. I'm trying to lead a different life for myself, she says. This money is a huge part of that decision. Paige's story is not unique. Guaranteed income advocates say modest cash payments are not enough to solve poverty or address its root causes. Instead, they merely loosen the financial straitjackets that have confined the beneficiaries most of their lives. Having a guaranteed income and a poverty floor enables people to have breathing room to make better decisions for their families, former Compton Mayor Brown says, to be able to spend time, to maybe be able to actually go on an interview, to be able to plan a few years in advance instead of having to live paycheck to paycheck. For Leo, the Compton Pledge payments are an answer to a prayer whispered earlier this year after months of financial hardship. "I asked the Virgin Mary for some sort of miracle," he says, from the covered patio outside his home that doubles as his stepson's bedroom. "An extra $3,600 per year will not pay off all his debts, buy him health insurance, or allow him to move his family out of their small rental home, which was converted from a car garage. The payments do, however, let him breathe a little easier." "Dios aprieta, pero no ahoga," explains Leo's stepdaughter Leslie. "God squeezes, but he does not choke." The Free Money Experiment was written by Abby Vasulis Compton and Abigail Abrams, with reporting by Mariah Espada at Nick Popley, Washington, and Leslie Dickstein, New York. Here are a few lines from the editor's inspirations column, the editor of Time being Edward Felsenthal. More than 90 years ago, Times editors realized they had somehow made it all the way through 1927, the year the aviator Charles Lindbergh made his historic solo flight over the Atlantic without putting him on the cover. So they invented a new franchise, then called Man of the Year, and selected Lindbergh in order to give him the credit he was clearly due. I thought of this story recently while corresponding with the legendary conservationist Jane Goodall, whose life's work in support of every living creature, as the actor Leonardo DiCaprio put it in a tribute to her, in these pages 2 years ago, has inspired millions. Time's been covering Goodall for more than half a century, starting with her groundbreaking ethology work in Tanzania in the 1960s, but we never put her on the cover. Fortunately, she consented to our proposal to rectify that with this issue, sitting for a portrait by the photographer Nadav Condor, who's done numerous covers for Time, including two U.S. presidents, and having a conversation with Time staff writer Ciara Nugent in the home in Bournemouth, England, where she grew up. We have run out of time for today's episode of Time Magazine. I hope you enjoyed it, and be sure to listen next time. I am Patricia, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Today's program is underwritten by G. Suggs Insurance. Please contact G. Suggs Insurance, your local independent agency, for trusted advice on home, auto, business, and life insurance. For more information, please visit gsuggsinsurance.com or call 919-875-8889. Time Magazine is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have comments or questions, call us at 919-832-5138. That is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.